By all extant metrics in security system review, this system should have failed instantaneously at every possible layer. And to be fair, it has failed at other layers. Bitcoin thefts have occurred in the metacode that surrounds the core technology itself. But the core technology actually works and has continued to work to a degree not everyone predicted. Time to enjoy being wrong. What the heck is going on here? The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. This is Bitcoin Audible, and I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. Sorry for the super low output lately. I think in the past week I have not even published an episode, but I'm about to smash through a ton of great reads before BitBlock Boom this week. Now that I've got this little gap, I'm just back from Mexico and the Bitcoin Standard Conference, which was just a ton of fun. It was great. Everybody who I got to meet there, guys, it was all of you, so great to hang out. And it was really a much more intimate conference than most. So I actually really got to meet people. You know, usually you're just kind of talk to somebody for 15, 20 minutes and you're rushed on to the next thing and then you're packing up and leaving. Like, you just barely get any time to actually meet somebody, like to actually hang out with somebody. And I got to hang out with, I feel like everybody there, which was awesome this time. I'll probably be posting some video of the dune buggy riding and stuff that we did, which was an absolute blast. Today, however, let's go ahead before I, tangent on this for an hour. We are reading a short but excellent little blast from the past by Dan Kaminsky. This guy was, we actually lost him this past year, but this guy was a giant in the security field, and I never really got to do a proper tribute to him, I guess you could say. He was super instrumental in so many different areas of the security industry. I mean, he's exposed vulnerabilities in like DNS system, the DNS system, which actually led to, I think it was called the DNS sec specification, I guess. I think that's what it's referred to. And he did so much work in calling attention to and then providing solutions for exploits in the Microsoft system. In fact, Clippy, you remember the Clippy assistant? He actually exposed so many different exploits and problems with the Microsoft Clippy assistant that Microsoft actually just got rid of it entirely because it was just too much to fix and nobody really seemed to like the thing anyway. But he was hugely influential in just so many different ways. He was very well respected in the industry, and everything I've read about him or all the takeaways from people who were around him, it genuinely seemed to have absolutely nothing but great things to say about him. And he died actually from complications. He had diabetes, and we lost him at 42, which is really young. We've got a piece today written by him back in 2013 about Bitcoin, and it was one that stuck with me and I had been meaning to come back to for a while. So now just feels like a good time. So with that, let's get into this piece by Dan Kaminsky, and it's titled, "I Tried Hacking Bitcoin and I Failed," by Dan Kaminsky, published on April 12th, 2013. 2 years ago, I tried to hack Bitcoin. I failed. This was very exciting. It is a fairly open secret that almost all systems can be hacked somehow. It is a less spoken of secret that such hacking has actually gone quite mainstream. Everybody hacks sometimes. But I'm not here to discuss the raging question that is, What do we do about the fact that we've built a global economy on a system optimized for moving pictures of cats? They really are very cute. Seriously though, as an engineer and as a hacker, and I promise you these are two very different things, Bitcoin surprised me. Here was a system with the following properties. Created an enormous global cloud of always-on listening machines. Spoke its own fiddly little custom network protocol. Written in C++, which for all of its strengths is not usually the safest thing in the world to be reading random internet garbage with. Directly implemented the delivery of a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow for any hacker who could break it. By all extant metrics in security system review, this system should have failed instantaneously at every possible layer. And to be fair, it has failed at other layers. Bitcoin thefts have occurred in the metacode that surrounds the core technology itself. But the core technology actually works and has continued to work to a degree not everyone predicted. Time to enjoy being wrong. What the heck is going on here? First of all, yes, money changes things. A lot of the slop that permeates most software is much less likely to be present when the developer is aware that, yes, a single misplaced character really could end the world. The reality of most software development is that the consequences of failure are simply non-existent. Software tends not to kill people, and so we accept incredibly fast innovation loops because the consequences are tolerable and the results are astonishing. Bitcoin was simply developed under a different reality. The stakes weren't obscured, and the problem wasn't someone else's. They didn't ignore the engineering reality. They absorbed it and innovated ridiculously. Different this time, for real. Bitcoin reflects an entirely alien design regime. To geek out a bit, in the context of actual security paranoia, C++ is actually a great choice. It allows for clean infrastructure, and if you know what you're doing, you actually know what you're doing. Modern languages like JavaScript and Ruby are great in that they do a huge amount for you under the surface, but then you don't actually know what they're going to do. Ruby got burned pretty badly recently when some systems listening on the network were a little too friendly. Engineering is a game of trade-offs. So, of course, is business. But all that was obvious 2 years ago, when my 15-point list of obvious likely bugs was systematically destroyed by a codebase that, quite frankly, knew better. What is obvious now? Bitcoin is actually an exploit against network complexity. Not financial networks or computer networks or social networks. Networks themselves. To be quite specific, Bitcoin is a rejection of the regulation of monetary flows. The cost of regulating any network actually goes up exponentially with the number of nodes that must be monitored. You need a hierarchy of systems to perform guard labor to make sure systems are behaving within declared parameters. But the cost of adding yourself to the Bitcoin network is not exponential. Yes, the cost increases over time. Bitcoin has something called a blockchain, which is a list of all transactions that have ever occurred ever. You can think of this as an account ledger, containing the content of every account everywhere. It's a lot of data, and it gets bigger every day. And every first-class participant of Bitcoin must have all of it in order for the system to work. You're probably thinking, there's no way that can work. Eventually, that becomes too much data, and Bitcoin eventually devolves into the present state of affairs with specially invested institutions forming the banking community. That is what I thought as well. We are right, but we are wrong. Barely scratched the surface. The system fails. But when? Storage and bandwidth are themselves getting hilariously inexpensive. You can't just ignore time like all those other programming languages. My mistake 2 years ago was thinking too much like an engineer and not enough like certain Business Insider readers. Bitcoin operates in a domain that is too big to regulate.
I predicted the number of systems monitoring Bitcoin transactions would fall, and it did, by about 75% last time I checked. What's important to realize is that it's not the size of the base that matters. It's the fact that, if it was truly threatened, the cost to add more nodes, people participating in the Bitcoin experiment, is much lower than the cost to prevent the addition of new nodes. There's just a deep network of hearts and minds that can keep the Bitcoin ledger alive. That all being said, Bitcoin has not actually won the day. There have been some major thefts, the Bitfloor grab at 24,000 BTC, the Linode cloud robbery of 46,703 BTC, even the single user steal at 25,000 BTC. But Bitcoin's profoundly cool design allows one to track the thieves. When $50,000 of Bitcoins is stolen today, and is $500,000 of Bitcoin 5 years from now, every last cent of that filthy lucre can be monitored with acute cryptographic precision until the end of time. And indeed, as far as I've seen, none of the stolen Bitcoin have actually been spent in any way. There's actually an entire ecosystem around Bitcoin. Websites, mining pools, and the like, all of which would have to stamp their approval on a transaction involving the obviously stolen funds, none of which has seemingly been asked to. And that's interesting, because possession of stolen property is and will forever be a criminal offense, and nothing is more provably stolen than the cryptographic taint of a transaction with money from a stolen account. Concentration of authority. I actually have no idea what will happen when these chickens come home to roost. Right now, everyone wins. Hoarding bitcoins is probably the optimum strategy, even if you didn't steal them. People who were robbed move on with their life in normal circumstances, and the ecosystem can pretend things are better now. The official truth of what money has changed hands is really in the hands of less than 5 or 10 organizations, and that's being generous. It's somewhat the case that if those actors really anger people, the flare-up could create a sort of cryptographically enforced uprising, whereby a new set of actors takes majority control of ground truth. But the power of the masses is only shrinking. Bitcoin made a technical choice during its initial design that allowed some people to do far more work than others, simply by having a graphical accelerator or even by designing custom hardware. This is the precise capability that large financial actors and nation-states have above and beyond the private sector's capacity to produce. And it's not obvious that even the Bitcoin developers have the political ability to override a technical choice that would also harm the technology's largest public players. I provide these details to make it clear. The Bitcoin experiment is not complete. There is actually quite a bit of interesting work to be done, and it's not at all clear what the future holds for the technology. Much thanks to Michael Tiffany and Ash Kalb, with whom many of these issues were discussed. All right, let's hit a quick sponsor break, and then I want to do a guy's take on Dan Kaminsky's piece and talk a little bit about the history behind this and Dan himself as well. The revolutionary aspect of Bitcoin is the power of self-custody, of sovereignty of ownership. Bitcoin is property in the digital age that you and only you can own with cryptographic certainty. But that is only if you hold your own keys. The BitBox O2 hardware wallet is exactly the tool designed for that job. You own the Bitcoin on your BitBox, not because some exchange says so, not because a government says so, and not because somebody else's wallet balance says they are allocated to you. You own it because those keys are on your BitBox, because those people cannot take your coins. I know a hardware wallet can seem intimidating at first, which is why a major part of the security, I think, is simplicity. And that's something the BitBox really has above the alternatives. It is secure, open source, and just intuitive to set up and use. So many of you guys have hit me up to say you've really enjoyed the BitBox, and I love the feedback. Thank you so much. It really does mean a lot. If you do not have yours yet, Go to my link at Guy Swan, Swan with two N's, guyswan.com/bitbox. And don't forget, code GUY gets you 5% off everything in your cart. Okay, so this was a really awesome piece. I stumbled upon it first. I mean, way, way, way back when there was hardly anything to read about Bitcoin, really. And I don't think, you know, it didn't even stick with me who Dan Kaminsky was at the time. I think it was actually many years later that I actually had any idea of the name or was familiar with him at all. But I did stumble upon this piece, and I don't remember how I need to keep better track of how I stumble back across things, because usually I'm like one of you guys actually recommend it to me. So if someone did send me this, big thank you for bringing it back to my attention, because I just kind of forgot about it. It's been a really long time. And his perspective is so great, because you forget, particularly when you're, you know, when you listen to the crypto space and everything, everybody just, oh, Bitcoin is old technology. And when you completely lose sight of these things as cryptographic systems, that this is truly, this is an absolute innovation in how networks are designed, the very nature of networks themselves. And I thought that was one of the most interesting takeaways from this piece, and how to think about Bitcoin. And that this is not, you know, I say it all the time, this is not about gadgets and widgets. This is about fundamental security and a way to achieve security and independence that scales to essentially the world population, right? How do you achieve trust that doesn't break down the more people that are included or subsumed by the network? Because usually those are antithetical to each other in a sense. Like, the way networks are currently designed is that as greater and greater numbers of people join the network, the greater and greater, exponentially so, the cost of having to deal with bots, the cost of having to deal with fraudulence, the cost of having to keep the system itself, keep the arrangement and the network and all of the interactions trustworthy and legitimate. That has been the problem of networks since networks. And there's a really great quote in this piece, this little section here. It says, Dan says, Bitcoin is actually an exploit against network complexity, not financial networks or computer networks or social networks, networks themselves. To be quite specific, Bitcoin is a rejection of the regulation of monetary flows. The cost of regulating any network actually goes up exponentially with the number of nodes that must be monitored. You need a hierarchy of systems to perform guard labor to make sure systems are behaving within declared parameters. But the cost of adding yourself to the Bitcoin network is not exponential. And what he's getting at here is that the regulation, how the system regulates itself, how it establishes a set of rules in which the incentive is so strongly for cooperation that the network by default automatically handles all of the behavior that's outside of those rules. It has a default way to essentially reject or protect, defend the network from all of the cheaters, from all of the fraudulence, from all of the fake signatures, etc., etc. And it can still be exploited at the edges. It can still be, you know, you can still have your computer hacked and have your keys stolen, but the core system, the network itself, does not allow the continuation or the proliferation of false information. And in doing so, it has a network now that can scale. Essentially, when you think about it from a philosophical standpoint, it can scale infinitely with new participants without actually having to vastly increase the cost of monitoring it. In fact, any cost of auditing and protecting the system is mere fractions of the cost of each additional node. You know, it doesn't change my computer's ability to protect and audit and enforce all of the rules of the Bitcoin system because 10,000 new people joined the network today, it treats it almost like it's almost virtually unchanged, really, especially when you consider the fact that there is a hard limit on the amount of data that can be input into the system, and its natural and dominant scaling profile is to deal with that off-chain in small, isolated situations. And when I'm talking about here, I'm using an analogy to lightning channels, that you are actually self-regulating your relationship with your channel partner, and you're connecting into a broader network, and everybody is doing this. And the ultimate reference point is Bitcoin, is the network settlement that cannot be cheated. It's our global totem to establish a new network on top of it. And it's such a profound innovation. It's such a crazy thing to think that just 12 years ago, 13 years ago, this wasn't obvious. This was not even close to the way any networks worked ever. Like, this was just completely alien to the world that existed. And we live in a very different place today. Bitcoin has fundamentally changed our means of thinking about and interacting with the idea of cryptographic systems. I really think this is just, it's so hard to understate just how profound the Bitcoin system is. And I actually skipped over a lot here for, just in the context, this is something that I talk about in the context of altcoins and shitcoins all the time, but this was just a really great quote. It says, quote, "The reality of most software development is that the consequences of failure are simply non-existent. Software tends not to kill people, and so we accept incredibly fast innovation loops because the consequences are tolerable and the results are astonishing." So that's been the mindset around development since the beginning of the internet, right? The stakes were so low always when it came to the internet. And really, the stakes got raised after all the development happened. And that's why we're rushing to kind of fill in gaps and holes. And even people like Dan Kaminsky had a job and was highly respected because, you know, as we suddenly had sensitive data on these computers, as suddenly we were using our credit cards online and trading extremely sensitive identity data, all of these things that, oh, well, it was great to just be able to get iteration after iteration so that my website's more fun and the internet's faster and all of this stuff when we weren't really doing anything important on it, you know, just sharing pictures of cats. But now suddenly this is a huge, huge system that's critical to security around our financial infrastructure, around our ability to do trade and communicate with each other in the normal ways that we communicate. And suddenly the stakes got raised without the security infrastructure being solved. We were still in the security of the old mindset, but the stakes were no longer the same. So there's this kind of mad scramble for the past couple of decades to suddenly realize just how important the internet is and attempt to band-aid together all of the solutions and plug all the holes that arose because we rushed to get the features before realizing how important the security was. And that's why I think Bitcoin actually fundamentally has a means and a potential incentive to actually redesign the internet itself. That if there was ever actually a move away from TCP/IP, which I don't really think there is because TCP/IP is just too simple in what it does. But I guess maybe the better way to put it is that the move away from the current architecture of the infrastructure, which has essentially re-centralized and become another huge point of failure for censorship, for control of speech, for control of what information people see, and also potential giant honeypots of incredibly sensitive data. All of our quote-unquote security measures were to put all of the incredibly sensitive data onto a single computer and try to put somebody we really, really trust in charge of it, which is the exact opposite of security, right? That's an absolute nightmare. And more of this sensitive data, the more of our lives go into the digital sphere, if we don't re-decentralize that, if we don't split all of that data up and put it in the hands of all of the individual owners, the people themselves, and create a security system that moves to the edges so that we don't have these giant honeypots, we don't have these centralized means of control and influence and exploitation, well, then simply put, we're going to have a really bad time. But going back to the idea of the quote-unquote crypto space is I think that's what the mindset is. I think the mindset is that rushed, we got to have as many features as possible. We got to, you know, throw the widgets on, as many widgets on top of it as we can. And look at all these fast and cool and cheap things that my project can do. And they're not thinking adversarially. They're not thinking about the deep incentives and the long-term trends that are consequences of these changes. You know, if take the Ethereum, for example, is that it continues to be a little bit more centralized every time it makes these changes. And even some of the core engineers of the system have made pretty much the same exact statement on some podcasts, that they're willing to accept centralization and willing to accept a trusted relationship in order to grow and get more users and to do more things. And that this is a trade-off that Ethereum will do that Bitcoin simply isn't willing to do. But look at this thing 40 years out. Look at this thing as a mechanism of survival that will create a trusted totem, something that everybody can know is actually safe and secure and does not get centralized to the point of becoming yet another politically manipulated, politically or socially decided system in which a very few handful of parties truly have essentially total control. All of these systems, if any of them is actually going to be a world money, these things need to scale and include activity and value to the tune of 1,000, maybe even 10,000 times the size that it currently is. If we are already accepting centralization now, if in 3 years we know it is going to be more centralized than it is today, then the trend is already, it's already done. The game's already over. The system simply is centralized. You go 10 years out, 20 years out, that only gets harder and harder and harder, and the trade-offs become greater and greater and greater to just centralize it to get the job done. However, if you have a system that gets just 1% cheaper to run a node, to create a new enforcer, to actually protect the system from cheating, and that it doesn't get bloated, and that it does a simple job like TCP/IP, that it just does exactly what it needs to do to secure the monetary base, and then we can build on top of it, then no matter how long we go into the future, it's going to at least be a little bit more decentralized, and maybe even a lot. Maybe it's massively better and easier to protect just because there are so many more people invested in it at such a higher degree, and there's such an incentive to protect this system because all of our wealth is inside of it. And, you know, like he says in this, like one bad piece of code, one bad bug is essentially, quote unquote, the end of the world. You don't want a complex, convoluted, bloated base that tends to centralize over time as the foundation of a global financial system with billions and billions of nodes and users and operators across the world. That is a horrible base to build from. It's the exact opposite of adversarial thinking, in my opinion. And one thing that Dan actually brings up in this piece that I thought that was so great is that, you know, usually the idea of protecting the system ebbs and flows. Is, you know, when everything's working and everybody's fair and all the businesses are, you know, there to help out and everybody's mining and there's no huge contention, well, there doesn't feel this great need to rush to Bitcoin's defense, right? It's like there's 80,000 nodes on the network. Why do I need to run one? But when the shit hits the fan, when a major adversary comes in, what is the cost to add new nodes? What is the cost for people to suddenly begin in that protection, to sink to the chain for the first time because they realize just how important it is? Just like we saw with the user-activated soft fork in 2017, what happens when that comes back around? When we have a challenge like that again, and we need more nodes, we need greater protection for the network, we need greater decentralization, Bitcoin's defensive layer can explode, and it can explode very quickly. And even if there's
a nuke dropped on 80% of the nodes on the network, we can spin those nodes back up. What about a system like Ethereum that has 8 terabytes or some crap in the actual archival nodes, the nodes that actually check everything from the beginning so that you know you're on the right chain and you know you've not been cheated? How long would it take for them to recover from even just a simple software bug in one of their, 800 hard forks that they're doing? If they had to resync, if they had to restart this from the beginning, it could take months and months just to get a handful of reliable nodes running on that system again. And that's critical to consider. This is about survivability. This is about assuming that we are going to, we're going to end up fighting massive, like major monetary adversaries in this battle before the end of it. The cost to add, just like Dan says in this, the cost to add more nodes, people participating and duplicating the Bitcoin software, the system itself, must be lower than the cost to prevent the addition of new nodes. And there's so much else that goes into that. You know, that's like, this is just one of so many different metrics and ways of thinking about the engineering of this system, both as a social network and as a monetary and cryptographic network, that, I mean, this, I mean, it's just conversation alone is so many episodes on this podcast, and you can hit it from 100 different perspectives. But I just love the kind of simplicity of Dan's perspective on this all the way back in, you know, all the way back in April 12th of 2013. And this was just such a, this was a really big pivotal piece for me in kind of reading and exploring what the Bitcoin system was and how to get my framing around it. I mean, there were so many over the course of time. But hat tip to Dan Kaminsky for all he did for this space and for security and cryptography in general, because if it weren't for people like him, if it weren't for so many of the cypherpunks and the people on the cryptography mailing list, it's amazing. It's amazing how much just a few people can accomplish with the right mindset and dedication. And Dan absolutely had that. And I loved his perspective on Bitcoin and his just kind of his fascination with the fact that he was wrong about this, and how it kind of threw him for a loop, and suddenly he's looking at this thing in an entirely different light. So with that, I guess we'll go ahead and close this episode out. Thank you guys so much for listening. I hope to be back with a lot published in the next week, so stay tuned. Don't forget to subscribe. Got a couple of major announcements and a really awesome chat coming in the future. You're not going to want to miss it, I promise. And a huge thank you to the Bitbox, to Shift Crypto, and that team for putting together the Bitbox, my favorite hardware wallet. And of course, to Swan Bitcoin, our other sponsor for the show. These guys really, the Shift Crypto and Swan Bitcoin are the reason this show is happening and the reason I can do all of this stuff and go to these conferences. So shout out for those guys for both just having awesome products, the Swan DCA and the Bitbox O2 hardware wallet, but also just for supporting my work and supporting the Bitcoin space. With that, thank you so much for listening, everybody. And until next time, take it easy, guys. This has been Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.